I want to read a piece tonight involving one of your local heroes who's been a fascination to me. One of your holy ghosts, Bob Marshall, namesake of the Wilderness area, who was a Missoula figure early in his Forest Service career. Briefly, just to give you some flavor of Marshall's time, 1925 to 1928, at the Northern Rocky Mountain Experiment Station, he was such a demon hiker, 40 to 50 miles a day, that he was called the Rocky Mountain Greyhound. According to his biographer, he also took a creative writing class at UM, began a career of eloquent articles that ultimately led to his famous wilderness credo, "How much wilderness do we need? How many Brahms symphonies do we need?" I became interested in Marshall when Carol and I backpacked into the Bob Marshall Wilderness in 1977. An unforgettable set of days, utterly alone with ourselves and the Bob, which was the basis for the climactic journey my characters take in Mountain Time, and which you'll hear just a bit of in this reading. I ultimately tracked down Marshall's notebooks at the Bancroft Library, was determined to use him in a book sometime, somehow. He was a weird and wonderful combination of geek and poet, an overachiever on the trail, and rich and socialist and bureaucratic string puller. I just find him a character nobody would believe if I made him up. So, here's a swatch of fiction he makes a bit of an appearance in. The main characters here are Mitch Rozier, who is the environmental reporter for a Seattle newspaper called Cascopia, one of those urban weeklies for people concerned to know the difference between tofu and futon. And Mitch writes a column called Coast Watch, a kind of ecological watchdog column. Mitch, at age 50, when the book takes place in 1996, is jelly sandwiched between the grown children he lost in an early divorce and an aging parent back in his hometown, back here. He is, in other words, that not unknown specimen in our land, a baby boomer beginning to feel the pressure of the years. Mitch, at this point in the book, has been joined in his hometown, one I made up and put into the country between Shoto and Augusta, where it seemed to me there's plenty of room for a town. He's joined by the McCaskill sisters, who have been helping him in trying to fend with his father's illness. Lexa McCaskill is Mitch's spousal equivalent, with whom he has been living out on the coast. And Mariah McCaskill, her older sister, is still a highly intense photographer for a Montana newspaper. The three of them are in the midst of a week-long hike into the Bob, for a reason I can't tell you without giving away the plot wholesale. Probably a few things about their hike will seem anachronistic. I don't know whether there would be a summer-long fishing camp with a teepee, as there was when Carol and I were back in there in 77, but just think of it as Scotch magical realism. Okay, from Mountain Time. It was only mid-afternoon when they came to the clear rush of water. Aspens pintoed the opposite bank, their leaves exquisitely trembling in the least whiff of breeze. From not far upstream poured the more industrious sound of a waterfall, 20 or 30 feet high, a toboggan of white water. The rocky side hill around the waterfall broke up through the valley floor, like the mammoth root of a mountain surfacing, strewing the stream bed and the slope down to it with stones the size of small flagstones. In the broken mosaic of it all, the water pooled and then tumbled down rapids like glass over marbles. "Ledge Creek," Lexa announced off her map. More than evidently, she was on the ledge, a low, smooth, sedimentary span that led like a little dock to where the shallow stream could be crossed on other flat stones. She had close company there. A rough, mounded cairn, no taller than she was, had been built on the ledge near the water's edge. Standing there, absorbing the glorious surroundings, she clapped her hat on top of the monument and ran her hand through her hair. The other two trailed up onto the vantage point next to her and the compact tower of rocks. "Well, it has some scenery," Lexus said. "Good-looking campsite." Mitch was watching her hopefully, and so was Mariah. Lexa chewed her lip, calculating. "It'll make a humongous day tomorrow, but we seem to be ready for this." She plucked her hat off the monument. "Okay, gang, let's go unload." As soon as they were on the other side of the creek, they saw they were not the first to think of it as a camping spot. A canvas teepee gray with age poked up not far downstream, and a nice, high, dry place handy to the water. No one around, though, when they approached it, and the campfire ashes were not recent. Inspecting, they whistled appreciatively at the amenities. Dragged up logs to sit on, a fire circle of blackened rocks, even a rusted but serviceable cooking grill that gladdened Lex's heart. Mitch zeroed in on the teepee, walking around it in admiration. "A tent tall enough to stand up in? Wouldn't that be too bad? Whoop!" He nearly fell over a bundle in the grass at the rear of the teepee. The others joined him and stared down at a rolled-up sleeping bag that had a foam mat wrapped around it for protection. The protection had not much worked. The foam had been vigorously gnawed through, shreds of bag fabric and tufts of down oozing out through the mauled mat. Lexa shot a look toward the teepee, Mitch and Mariah an instant after her. Muddy paw prints at shoulder height showed where the animal, evidently up on its hind feet like somebody nearsighted feeling along a wall, had padded along the canvas of the teepee until deciding to rip its way in. The trio stared at the claw-cut slash, big enough for a grizzly to walk through. "We can assume the grizz isn't in there anymore," Lexa deduced. Their combined six eyes frisked the low brush along the creek. "So then, where is he? It?" Trying not to sound nervous, Mitch wanted to know with some urgency. "Don't we want to clear out of here?" "Minutes ago," chimed Mariah, her head swiveling back and forth steadily as a radar dish. "Probably not," Lexa figured out loud. "The bear's been and gone. If we're careful to make noise and build a fire, generally announce ourselves, maybe it isn't likely to bother back here again real soon." Zweiborg, who was the team leader of a bear-tagging team Lexa was on in Alaska, Zweiborg used to say, "Each grizzly bear has a hunting territory bigger than Rhode Island." "Lexa, Rhode Island's the most microscopic state." "Mitch, if a bear wants to come visiting, it could come visiting if we were camped out on the trail somewhere." "I'm not for that either," he conceded. "Okay then," Mariah voted, shucking off her backpack. "If we're going to be eaten, let's be eaten in comfort." They banged cooking pots together and whooped and hollered for some minutes, a racket that they felt would clear any self-respecting grizzly out of the valley. Then turned to the night's hostelry, unsnugging the teepee flap and stooping in like cave explorers. Strewn in there were other sets of mat-encased bedrolls, tossed around by the bear after some sample bites. "Fishing camp," Mariah pointed to the rod tips sticking out of the ends of a few of the foam rolls. "Hunter-gatherer time," Lexa exulted. "His clan's tools of the trade, right here," Mariah happily seconded. They could form alliances quicker than he could turn around, Mitch too late realized. "Sexism," he protested. "Fishermanism. How about if I spread doilies around in here while you two go kill fish?" The McCaskill sisters only snickered. "What's the use of having an alpha male along?" Mariah was asking Lexa rhetorically. "If he won't get out there an alf." Lexa knew another formula. "Fried trout for supper," she cooed in Mitch's direction. "Golden brown. Just crisp enough you can eat them with your fingers, like corn on the cob. If only some big strong manzie would go catch them." "You are the Bobbsey twins from hell," Mitch observed. A bit of soothing came from Mariah, who said she might as well come help slay trout after the teepee was kicked into shape. Well, Alexa said she wanted the leisure of setting up a camp kitchen in style for a change. I'm skipping a section here where they go fishing. It's not nearly like the plot of A River Runs Through It, as Norman MacLean used to love to describe it. They go fishing, they get drunk, and then they go fishing. These folks just are out to catch a few fish. They do catch some, and Mitch and Mariah came rolling back into camp like old whaling chums, showing off their catch on a willow stringer apiece, the trout lovely as jewel-dusted jade. Lexa got busy on supper. The campfire smoke behaved beautifully, twining straight up like a mystic rope trick. In daylight's last act at this spot, aspen shadows danced on the creek water. The waterfall drew silver from the air. She kept marveling around over her shoulder as she pottered the meal together. She was frying the trout when she heard the sound of a keyboard in use. Mitch was hunched on a jackpine log, tapping away at the laptop across his knees. "You packed that?" Lexa stormed. Squeak of the frying pan's bottom as she yanked it across the campfire grill to inspect the golden brown fish. "Wonder I got stuck with carrying all the cooking gear and most of the food, too." "I had to, Lexa. Any of my Bob Marshall stuff is on disk." Looking caught, he chucked back into his pack the extra batteries he'd brought, away from her counting eye. "The guy was a hiking machine," he alibied lightly. "I thought I'd pick up some tips." Silence met that. "Habit, Lex, okay?" He came clean. "Even if I don't have any place to write for anymore?" Supper in them and the fire pleasant. They sat watching a placid sunset, the last light raying like golden spokes through the treetops on the rim of the valley. The minute the sun went down, Mitch dug out his laptop again with a wary glance at Lexa. "Play April in Paris," Mariah requested dreamily. He vamped a run along a piano keyboard, and even Lexa broke up. "All right, techie gear freak," she said in resignation. "What's with our man Bob?" "He was a strange one," Mitch shook his head. "Maybe saints in any trade are. Marshall was a kind of a bean-counting poet." He hit a few keys and peered close to read off the small screen. "First snow on the Lolo Trail, September 6, 1928. The path was too muddy to show white so soon, but the grass along the sides and the surrounding trees were already blanketed. Under this cover, flowers, berries, mosses, highly pigmented rocks, everything that made the forest warm and colorful had vanished. In a few hours, the season had jumped from late summer completely over autumn and had landed frigidly in January." Mitch bopped the side of his head with the flat of his hand in admiration. "You get that from him 1 minute. Next, he's geeking around counting every son of a bitching thing. Literally. Conversation between lumberjacks today. God, 38. Damn, 33. Jesus, 16. Christ, 13. On down through bastard hell. You get the picture." He joined the others' laughter at the hallelujah chorus of swearing. "How was he on sightings of bears?" Mariah went facetiously wide-eyed. "Like how many g-g-g-" "Don't start with that," Mitch glanced into the coming dark. "Nobody in the history of Rhode Island," Lexa pitched in and with a lecturing tone, "has ever ended up as a hide on the floor of a grizzly's den." "Miles on the trail," Mitch adamantly steered his topic past theirs. "Marshall kept track of every one of those babies. I'm up to 1938 in his notebook, and here's the kind of thing over the flathead. 8 day totals. Miles, 288. Feet climbed, 54,000. Number of peaks ascended, 20. As she heard this, the back of Lex's neck prickled. She, too, had the impulse to always tally the distance she had covered, calculate the outdoors into herself incessantly. The same mainspring that drove her to measure herself against the clock in barrel racing when she was a kid, perhaps. Whatever installed it, ever since the first time she set foot into these mountains and took off up a grassy mountainside with Mariah while their father dealt with a sheep herder, she would run through her mind a sweet, sad estimate of the amount of time ahead how many more years of hiking she had left if she lived to be such and such. Jesus! Mariah let out in a way Bob Marshall would have given her extra points for. What'd he do, run? Pushed himself like crazy, Mitch confirmed. That probably was what killed him. Remember, all he was doing in the Forest Service in the meanwhile was installing the wilderness system against every old bull of the woods who figured trees are there to be chopped down. So there he was, dead at 38. Makes those of us who are too old for drugs and too young for Alzheimer's wonder what the hell we ever spent any time at. Brutally, he heaved a piece of wood onto the campfire, sparks taking to the air. Spooky last chapter for you, I told the women watching him in the firelight. The Obits say Marshall went back to Washington from one of his high lonesomes out here. Right away, died on the train to New York. Conductor found him in his sleeper when the train pulled into Penn Station. Lead us not into Penn Station, Mariah said reflectively in preacher tone. Lexa seemed to be appraising every scuff on her veteran hiking boots. They talked on for a long while, held by the fire, and a demon hiker who believed mountains made the difference in the world. This last little section is from later in the book, later in their hike, and again, for plot reasons, I can't tell you which of the McCaskill sisters is plunging back down the trail, solo. Here she comes. Mitch, damn, why? He jumbled in with every thought she tried to put to the day she had ahead of her. The mountain's severe shoulder, the gorge, the corrugated valley before the Ledge Creek crossing, the weather, the clouds closed in up here. She stopped and tightened her laces so her boots were firm on her ankles and kept the toes from jamming. Then set a steeled, careful pace, not to pound herself too much on the trail, yet make steady time. Her mind jittered back into the night, to the hours of furious thrashing. Lots of mental coin flips you have to do in life. Who appointed Mitch to be the decider? She knew in the heart of her despair that he'd have said, they all did. The old holies of Earth watching, his laptop tribe of wordslingers. Muir, she breathed in as her right foot lifted. Leopold, rhythmed the exhale to the stride of her left. Stegner, her boot dodged a fist-sized rock in the trail. Abby, the other boot set a firm mark into the dust-filmed ground. Bob, Marshall jounced down the identical shoulder of Phantom Woman Mountain. His boot prints an everlasting instant coinciding where hers were alighting in the dust of the trail. The bulging canvas pack on his back, gray-shadowing her Kelty. She and he, together, breathing the thin air of a not enough time. Now that he was down out of sight of the fire tower and could write without setting off the nervous young ranger, Marshall made himself stop. He batted a persistent horsefly from the vicinity of an ear, then creased open his notebook to this day's page, June 21, 1939. Poor old notebook. Nothing but interruptions today. Lunch to smooth the ranger's feathers, then that doozy of a close call on the stair landing of the fire tower. Shortcut to the parlor of the funeral sort. But didn't happen. It will when it will. And until then, he would get away every chance he could, up here away from the swarm. The Gates of the Arctic was his first entry in this summer's well-creased notebook. And since then, the California mountains and the Cascades up through Oregon and Washington, and now the old loved Rockies. All of it to take the miles and words back with him to what passed for civilization. He shifted the balance of his pack to the inward side of the trail, away from the drop of the gorge. Already he could taste missing this, the continent's center of gravity, the high, wild equilibrium in these mountains, an earth all lowland, entirely gentle and cliffless, invited engineering and the tame patterns of residence. He did a sum of the miles hike to the fire tower from where he'd started that morning. To his category, marker cairns observed on the divide, added the final three and their locations. Flipped through to the page where he kept his lingo tally. for a moment impishly pursing his lips at how the fire tower crew swore no stronger than seminary girls. Half a dozen gollies out of the Ranger, Eliason. 3 uses of son of a gun by the blocky CCC boy. Done with those, he tucked the notebook in his shirt pocket and resumed his mile-eating pace. 3 days earlier, he had set out from Mariah's Pass, straight from his sleeper on the Empire Builder to the trail up from the depot. He had wanted to follow as much of the Continental Divide as he could in the short week left to him before he had to go back to office life, to call it that. Reports to be written on this Western swing and be seated among his allies and the alphabet agencies in Washington. Life was this, the High Lonesome. The other was obligatory existence. The chores of paper and committee. And then he had that trip to New York to make. Its canyons, the dead opposite of these wild passages. When Tom Chambliss asked me here to join Jim and Eric in talking about the right stuff, the WRITE stuff, he told me I should tell you about the evolution of my book. Make it memorable, he said, and be funny about it. Oh, and wake them up while you're at it. I asked him how much time I had for all that, and he said 10 to 15 minutes. Wake up in a hurry, or you're going to miss the rest of it. I have 2 stories to tell you. In one, art imitates life, and I come out of it with the makings of a novel. In the other, life imitates art, and let's see, when we get there, what's been gathered in by that second parenthesis of fate. Tale number 1 begins at a campsite, as I say in the book, in a mountain valley as old as the visit of glaciers. About 5:30 on the morning of the 4th of July, 1977. I say, frost on the tent, huh? My wife Carol, beside me in the sleeping bag, says, nope, it's inside the tent. That summer of 1977, I was trying to find a reconciliation with the Montana I had left 15 years before. Economic propulsion had sent me out of the state, and then as my father's life dwindled into his long dying, Montana became for me a site of sickness, sadness, strain. But now I was back, trying to write about it, and determined, too, to do something none of us in our family had had time or freedom to do, to go deep into the Rocky Mountain front, the neighboring family of mountains behind the little town of Dupuyer during our sheep-herding years, my high school years. Carol and I backpacked into the Bob Marshall Wilderness that start of July, along a little used packhorse trail, which of course spells unbridged streams. 3 fordings of Birch Creek in the first 4 hours, the water at the last crossing up toward our waists. After we had earned our way onto some actual trail, everywhere around were the mountainsides of colossal reefs and deeps like the ocean bottom tipped empty and left on its side. Day on day, dodging weather by the hour, we hiked, camped, fished, enjoyed, and I tucked away the right stuff in a pocket notebook. The morning of that sparkling frost inside our tent, we started to hike out of the bob with brilliant blue above. Before noon, on a section of trail where, behind us, below us, lay the Continental Divide, we were in a sleet squall. When the squall cleared, the view was waiting. The Rockies, blading up in all directions, peak upon peak upon peak, with a notch of view eastward to the patterned farmland of the plains. There, at noon, on our 4th of July high, Carol asked, "So where does the map say we are?" I traced the contour lines with my finger and told her, "On a place named Family Peak." We aimed ourselves for that notch between the peaks and hiked out of the bob with the wind thumping a farewell against the backs of our packs. As it had for 5 days, the trail remained empty except for us. We had, in our time in that wilderness area, seen not another living soul. Something, though, by whatever token, the standard journalist that I was when I went into those mountains, came out to not only complete the memoir, This House of Sky, but to write novel after novel about a century of people on the hem of those mountains and those plains. The contemporary arc of this latest one, Mountain Time, takes place with a sense of the immense clock of Earth, the patient witness of mountains as they look down on the briefer existences that are our human fate. And I think it's more than a coincidence that the book's plot of family, of the baby boom generation reaching its time of reckoning, jelly sandwiched between children who are taking their own oft-times inexplicable routes in life, and aging parents who are losing command over their lives, is key to the view back there in 77 from a place called Family Peak. It's a view, incidentally, that I tried to write of from the heart rather than the irony gland, as, say, you've seen happen in a recent Millennium-centered bestseller-to-be that didn't manage to best-sell. Centuries have turned before without a novelistic curl of the lip. There's a lot of irony around in fiction today, and one reason is that it's easy. In the only sports page analogy I hope ever to use, irony is the literary equivalent of a baseball player letting a pitch hit him in the butt. It gets you on base every time, no matter how ignominiously. I think, though, that people's lives are ultimately lived in earnest, not in irony. I'm at best a distant cousin of the baby boomers, born as I was in the year World War II began. But I've been fascinated with the mammoth behavioral bulge caused by that generation, and I believe that the age group, tempered by the 1960s, deserve more than ironic treatment as they move from rebellion to the oldest kind of family obligations. Now to that other story I have for you. Mountain Time is about divides of various kinds, not simply the geographically unarguable continental divide, but the territory between individuals and segments of society. And since I live in the Seattle of the 1990s, one of those societal slices has money all over it. The latest cybernair, as invented by me, is named Aaron Frelinghuysen, and he's described this way. The guy had more money than most nations. Frelinghuysen had piranhaed his way into the Techieville food chain with a bit of wonderware called ZYX, and from Silicon Valley to Silicon Alley, the deals had lined up for him. No sooner had I finished having my characters encounter this latest computer Bigfoot and sent the manuscript in to Scribner than life did a little imitation of art for me. I was plucked out of my orderly, ordinary routine of sitting there pecking out words and wafted to Alaska on the wings and keels of money. Major money. The fortune of Paul Allen. The cruise ship bash thrown by Allen had a guest list of Robin Williams, Dan Aykroyd, Steven Spielberg, Carrie Fisher, Debbie Reynolds, Penny Marshall, Terry Gilliam, the musicians Lou Reed and Vernon Reed, Clyde Drexler, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Dennis Hopper, Bill Gates, probably half a dozen future Nobel laureates of science, and 400 or so others. Through some toss of the godly dice, I was one of two writers invited, sort of like winning a lottery you didn't know you had a ticket on. The days Carol and I spent with that shipload are in my diary under the heading, Afloat with Half the Money in the Known World. But the example I wanted to bring to you tonight is the heightening, the stretching, that a writer, I think, has to try to do when handed something like that. Out of many, many scenes from the big Paul Allen floating party, let me give you just the final night potlatch, when the upper deck of one of the most posh cruise ships in the world was transformed into a mammoth replica of a coastal Indian longhouse, with a rock band playing and gorgeously caped performers of the Tsimshian tribe dancing and Hollywood starlets slinking by in slinky gowns. It was like the Star Wars bar. There at the edge of the dance floor sits Candace Bergen, being herself rather than Murphy Brown, watching in open, utter fascination as the greatest artist of the Tsimshians, Nathan Jackson, performs his Raven dance. There's Jeff Goldblum, not in Jurassic Park or in The Big Chill, but in the buffet line with roast buffalo on his plate. And there on the rotunda next to the dance floor, the totem pole carved specially for this night, is a man dancing alone. A man who in an earlier turn of his life had been a commercial fisherman in Alaska and survived the sinking of a crab boat, he told me, that plunged him into these exact cold northern waters, now cut by the keel of the cruise ship Crystal Harmony. He dances and dances with a passion and privacy of a man who has handed his life back, and his movements on the rotunda set the Thunderbird totem pole to nodding in rhythm with him. And over along the wall, unabashedly standing on top of a chair to see out into this scene, is a white-bearded writer on a ladder of life where he surely has never been. But up there, writing, writing into that pocket notebook that he always carries next to his heart. May 25th, 1939, which reports that a downpour started in the early morning of the 22nd. It went on all through the day and into the night, and out inch and two-thirds of rain before it quit. Opportune for the crops, the homespun columnist states with satisfaction about that fog forecast goose drowner. And I sit, thinking of all the rain that must have seemed like, after the years of drought, the land suddenly swimming with valuable moisture, and more of it coming as May went off the calendar wetly. Steps on the stairs. It is the volunteer evening librarian telling me apologetically that she has to close up now. I close the red binder on the 1939 newspapers, go out into the summer night there under the northern Rockies. A couple of years later, when my novel English Creek is published, there in my fictional version of the summer of 1939, a forceful ranch-born woman named Beth McCaskill shows up almost immediately. And the book's opening sentence reads, "That month of June swam into the Two Medicine Country." Fact, I'm glad to say, also goes out to eat and drink. And here in the West, that sometimes can be especially slow and poetic. There is a delicious hunger of the ear behind stories, either the hearing of them or the telling of them. And I spend a lot of time simply following the sound of voices. It begins at breakfast in Shoto, Montana, Cortez, Colorado, or Chico, California, when the guys in tractor caps take over their usual table, start drinking coffee, solving the world's problems. Folklorists actually have a term for those caffeine circles. They call them the big table. I've always just called them the geezer table. But in any case, those gatherings over morning coffee or 4th of July rodeo picnic potato salad or evening imbibings in bars, usually called the Stockman or the Mint, are a rhythm of the West that I, at least, believe is worth some listening to. Something must account for this kind of example, a bit of dialogue in my novel Ride With Me, Mariah Montana, overheard between two beer drinkers in Shelby, Montana. Tell you, Ron, I don't know what you got going with Barbara Jo, but don't let her get you in front of no minister. This marriage stuff is really crappy. You take, Jeannie's mom is always on my back about why don't we come over more. But we go over there and the stuff she cooks, she never salts anything or anything. And I don't eat that crap without no salt on it. Then there's Jeannie's dad. He just got dried out down at Great Falls. Cranky old son of a bitch. I think they ought to let him have a few beers so he wouldn't be so much of a crap head, is what I think. And you know what else? Jeannie's brother and sister-in-law had a 4th of July picnic and didn't even invite us. That's the kind of people they are. Jeannie and I have been talking a lot lately. I told her I about had it with her crappy family. As soon as the first of the year and I get enough money ahead to buy my big bike, I'm heading out to the coast and go to school somewhere. Yeah? Ron responded. What in? Social work. In this particular case, that swatch of bar talk was about half overheard, including, I swear, on an oral history manual, that punchline, and half made up by me. The made-up half has in it the trace element of fact that wasn't there for me as an eavesdropper, folklorist, oral historian, researcher, writer, whatever. The echo of Exodus that sweeps back and forth in the West, this time our incipient social worker's dream of heading out to the coast. A long time ago, in a galaxy far away called Ireland, my wife Carol and I were being shown around Yeats country so enthusiastically that mundane matters such as mealtimes never came into the picture. Ah, never mind, the Irish woman who was doing the relentless showing told us. It'd taste all the better when we did finally eat. Hunger is good sauce, said she. I believe that if a writer is lucky, he or she early on gets afflicted with a hunger for detail and language. In my own case, when I was still down there in the vicinity of the elbow, a new relevance, in Bill Stafford's term, came into my life, a kind of Northern Lights out loud compared to the rambled through West that was my father. And it began to speak to me. You're not sugar nor salt, nor nobody's honey, so the rain will never hurt you, she crooned to me. That one goes around looking like she's been yanked through a knothole backwards, she huffed about our worst-dressed neighbor. And she confided about the couple dallying together in our wide-eyed little town. Those two were as close as three in a bed, with one kicked out. Into my life had come that river of proverbs, my grandmother. I was 10 years of age, but my ears were as old as sin. All of a sudden, I knew I was in new territory of life, something like honorary adulthood. Now, besides my Scotts-Burr storytelling widower father, here was my mother's mother, in this reluctant knot of bloodline the two of them had made to raise me. You bet my ears were busy from then on with the picture play of words from my grandmother, whose formal education had broken off at the third grade. Whenever the prairie wind would swirl up her dress and she would announce, "Balloon ascension!" Or with the bloodstream music of rhyme when my father, from the heights of his eighth grade education, would ask, "Have they taught you this one yet?" and begin reciting to my dropped jaw, "Hiawatha." It lasts. We've known so ever since art began to dance off the cave walls to us. Literature perhaps begins there, in the painted bison running in the tunnels of time, and the hunting escapades they represent being told around the fire. I think that's what we're still up to.
in the white canyons of paper, and now the nebulae of cyberspace. I think stories still can be our way of sharing light, of sitting together around humanity's fire with the universal dark all around us. Our work, our words, of course, have to start on the cave walls between our own ears. When I'm asked at book signings and readings what my working habits are, I hardly know what to say except pathological diligence. I began as a journalist, and so don't believe in that malady called writer's block. I never did meet a newspaper or magazine editor who would say, "Oh, that's all right, we'll just run a blank space there where you can't think of anything to say." The point always is to get something down on paper, describe a character, make up dialogue, dig something out of your pocket notebook or power book. In my case, I write a given number of words a day on a manuscript, a given number of days a week, a given number of weeks a year. This varies from book to book. On novels such as English Creek, it was 1,000 words a day. On others, it's been 400. So that the job isn't a permanent assembly line. Do I actually keep track of this daily output? You bet. I have a work calendar, just a plain one with plenty of white space for each day. It used to be given out by our fuel oil company, but now I have to go out and buy some yuppie variety. And I mark my total of pages on it each day, write the running total at the end of each week. I once read a sneering comment by some critic about Hemingway to the effect that Hemingway was so insecure that he actually counted every word he wrote every day. I thought to myself, hell, that's the best thing I've ever heard about Hemingway. Try as writers will, however, to turn the process into a recipe, there are always the unwritten down ingredients, the pinch of this, the sift of that. One that particularly intrigues me in literary hash slinging, let us call the crocodile factor. Like so much else that has to do with the heart and soul of the American West, I owe this bit of writerly psyche to the late Richard Hugo, the bigger-than-life poet of Washington and Montana. In teaching aspiring poets at the University of Montana, Dick Hugo used to advise, when in doubt, throw in a crocodile. Among the bites of the imagination he meant by that are a list of pretended assumptions that he would use when he set out to write a poem. As Hugo told it in his marvelous book on writing, The Triggering Town, whenever I see a town that triggers whatever it is inside me that wants to write a poem, I assume at least one of the following. And I'll give you just a few from Hugo's long list. I am an outcast returned. Years ago, the police told me to never come back to this town, but after all this time, I assume that either I'll be forgiven or I will not be recognized. On Saturday nights, everyone has fun but me. I sit home alone and listen to the radio. I wish I could join the others, though I enjoy feeling left out. A couple more Hugoisms that he used to inspire his town poems. The annual picnic is a failure. No one has a good time. Or, the annual picnic is a huge success, but it's the only fun people have all year. And a last Hugoian crocodilian turn of thought. There is one prisoner in the town's jail, always the same prisoner. No one is certain why he's there. He doesn't want to get out. People have forgotten his name. That one, Richard Hugo used in perhaps the greatest poem we have about mining towns, the ghost towns that haunt our national past. His poem, Degrees of Gray in Phillipsburg, in that magnificently wild first stanza. You might come here Sunday on a whim, say your life broke down. The last good kiss you had was years ago. You walk these streets laid out by the insane, past hotels that didn't last, bars that did, the tortured try of local drivers to accelerate their lives. Only churches are kept up. The jail turned 70 this year. The only prisoner is always in, not knowing what he's done. Hugo's kind of adjuration to the imagination is said many ways, probably in all forms of art. When the great carver Bill Reed was asked why his tribe, the Haidas, were the preeminent artists of the Northwest coastal tribes, he said the Haidas simply outcrazied everybody else. But I've always liked Hugo's crocodile prescription. I think it covers a lot of otherwise unexplainable wonders of prose, too. The gopher broke elements that come right up off the page and get you. The vital pulse on the page that I don't know what to call except the blood sum of the writer. Magical, inexplicable, whatever it is, but the literary quality by which a writer writes better than he has any right to, by which Faulkner, who could barely rouse himself to sort mail in a somnolent post office, had somewhere in him the ambition as a writer to put everything into one sentence, not only the present but the whole past on which it depends and which keeps overtaking the present second by second. By which Yeats, his pince-nez eyeglasses perched on his upper crust nose, somehow, could see deeply to where all ladders start in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. I tried to write about that hunger in the blood a bit in Heart Earth, the memoir about the short life of my mother, that brought my thinking back to the Southwest, where my life was turned when I was 5 years old. Here's the section of my father and my mother and I, Montana ranch people to the bone, fetching up in the winter of 1944 in a borrowed cabin in the desert outside Wickenburg, Arizona. Neighbors now consisted of lizards and scorpions. The mountains wavering up from every horizon looked ashen, dumpy. No pelt of sagebrush to soften this country for us either. Saguaro cacti, with their spiky mittens out, stubbled the hills. Where the familiar black-green of Montana's jack pines would have shadowed, here the bare green blush of Palo Verde scarcely inflected the gulches, arroyos. And under every other bristling contortion of vegetation, prickly pears crouched like shin-hunting pygmies in ambush. Even the desert bird sounds had a jab to them, the ha-ha of a gambled quail invisibly derisive in the bush, the yap of a Gila woodpecker scolding us from his cactus penthouse. I loved every fang and dagger of it. Any bloodline is a carving river, and parents are its nearest shores. At the Faulkner Creek Ranch in Montana, I had learned to try out my mother's limits by running as fast as I could down the sharp, shale slope of the ridge next to the ranch house. How I ever found it out without cartwheeling myself to multiple fractures is a mystery, but the avalanche angle of that slope was precisely as much plunge as I could handle as a headlong 4- and 5-year-old. The first time my visiting grandmother saw one of my races with the law of gravity, she refused ever to watch again. Even my father, with his survivor's eye view from all the times life had bunged him up, even he was given pause by those vertical dashes of mine, tyke roaring drunk on momentum. But my mother let me risk. watched out her kitchen window, my every wild downhiller, hugged herself to bruises while doing so, but let me. Because she knew something of what was ahead, can it have been that clear to her, that reasoned? The way I would grow up after was contained in those free-fall moments down that shale-bladed slope. In such plunge, if you use your ricochets right, you steal a kind of balance for yourself. You make equilibrium moment by moment because you have to. Amid the places and people I was to live with, I practiced that bouncing equilibrium and carried it on into a life of writing, free-falling through the language. It has brought me, among other places, here, and it had better take me next to an exit paragraph of these musings about makings. For all of my love of the West and my books about the region and its people, I don't particularly think of myself as a Western writer. To me, language, the substance on the page, that poetry under the prose, is the ultimate region, the true home for a writer. Specific geographies, but galaxies of imaginative expression. We've seen them both exist in William Faulkner's postage stamp size Yaknapatawpha County, in Ismail Kadera's chronicle in stone of a nowhere little Albanian city tossed back and forth with the dice of war, in Roddy Doyle's hilarious, heartbreaking, rough beasts of dialogue in his Barrytown trilogy of the Dublin slums, in Nadine Gordimer's fearlessly particularized stories from a land of laws made of skin and hair, South Africa under the apartheid regime. If I have any creed that I wish you as readers, necessary accomplices in this flirtatious ceremony of reading and writing, will take with you from my pages, it'd be this belief of mine that writers of caliber, the ones I admire, can ground their work in specific land and lingo, and yet be writing of that larger country.